You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Omar.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Glad to be with you.
Okay. Well, let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are Omar Badar, Deputy Director of the Arab American Institute.
That's right.
And let me set the context for this. So not that long ago, I had Wajahat Ali on to talk about a piece he had written for The Atlantic called, A Muslim...
A Muslim Among Settlers, yep.
Okay, and it was about his travels in the West Bank. It got a certain amount of blowback, in particular from Palestinian activists, and you are Palestinian-American and an activist, I guess you'd say, on the Israel-Palestine front.
Yep.
And the blowback included a piece that you co-authored with Noura Erekat. And so I was on Twitter, and somebody suggested that having heard Wajahat's side of things, I should hear your side of things. And I said, fine. I did try during my conversation with Waj to, kind of to some extent represent your side to the extent that I could imagine your side. I hadn't actually read your piece when I talked to him.
Yeah.
But I thought I could imagine the kinds of blowback his piece would get.
And I thought you covered some decent ground with that as well.
Yeah, so. I tried to some extent be a stand-in for your perspective. And by the same token, I guess I'll try to be a stand-in for him in talking to you. And then maybe to some extent when we broaden this to talk about the Israel-Palestine question, I'll be a stand-in for Israel, trying to play devil's advocate there. This is my job, to be everyone's stand-in. I guess it would be easier for me to just get out of the way and let them talk to each other. And maybe sometimes we should do that. Maybe we should do that more. But anyway, why don't we just start out with you telling us what your most leave aside for now the issue. I guess I didn't mention this, that as a result of this piece that he wrote and maybe some other things he had written, he was disinvited by the Islamic Society of North America to something an annual conference he had been scheduled to attend. That's
right.
An issue in its own right. But before we get to that, why don't you just tell us what your basic criticism of his Atlantic piece is?
So really the fundamental thing, I think, with the Atlantic piece is that it sets the audience off on the wrong foot and that it frames the entire issue incorrectly. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it ends up being portrayed as a problem of antipathy between Muslims and Jews. You know, there's a religious frame that is really hyper-imposed on it. And so you will hear him say things like, you know, what Jerusalem means to different religious groups. And he will say, Jerusalem is considered occupied land for Muslims. It's considered liberated territory for Jews. And it's the site of the Jesus crucifixion for Christians. And suddenly you lose all objectivity because it becomes, oh, this is what this land means to different religious groups. Somehow they all have equal claims to this very subjective, you know, piece of land. And you lose a sense of right and wrong, and you lose a sense of who the occupier and who the oppressor is and who are the occupied and oppressed populations. So that's the primary issue. And it also erases Palestinian Christians, who are a pretty significant, stakeholders in the issue. They live under the same occupation that every other Palestinian lives under. And by portraying this as a Muslim-Jewish issue, you are erasing the Palestinian Christians in general. And I think that that also feeds into a narrative that Israel would like to push on this conflict, is that they want it to be subjective. They want the issue of occupier and occupied to be basically set aside and relegated to a minor thing and have people focus on this as a problem of dealing with the Muslims and what they want, because I think it's fair to say there's a fair bit of Islamophobia in the United States. So the more they can create that common cause as dealing with Muslims as a problem, the more that serves their agenda, and they can relegate, just remove Palestinian Christians out of that picture entirely, who are suffering under Israel's occupation. There's the second thing that I think is, frankly, maybe even a bigger problem, is the false equivalence he sets on responsibility for the absence of peace on both sides. So he ends up devoting a lot of energy to humanizing settlers and humanizing Palestinians, and also talking about extremist settlers and extremist Palestinians, and ends the piece with this idea that there are two obstacles to peace, which is what Israel's doing, and the second obstacle is the Palestinian attitude towards Israel. And frankly, anybody who knows anything about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict knows that this is a preposterous suggestion. Throughout the peace process from the early 1990s, Palestinians have offered one concession after another, bending over backwards, trying to accommodate every American and Israeli demand to figure out a solution to this conflict, and Israel just kept insisting on taking more and more. So Palestinians recognized Israel proper on 78% of historic Palestine, you know, nearly 80%. And what they wanted in return was the occupied territories, which are a very small piece of land compared to historic Palestine. And what Israel did was respond by building more and more settlements on those territories. And now Israel blatantly just says that they are not even interested in having Palestinian state or Palestinian independence. So when you have that dynamic, to portray this as equal responsibility for the absence of peace is really just simply wrong. And to have it come out from somebody who has the credibility as a pro-Palestinian voice, which is the way he's presented on all the platforms that he's speaking at, is really troubling and misleading.
Okay, let's start with the first point you made. You focused on his phrase, on his focusing on the antipathy of Muslims. There's really two issues there. There's the fact that he's focusing on Muslims, and as you said, that makes it sound like a religious conflict, when in fact there are non-Muslim Palestinians, a non-trivial number of Christian Palestinians who are also not happy about the occupation. But then you also mentioned antipathy. Now, Then you said the real issue is a question of occupation or dominance and subjugation and so on, as opposed to one of the antipathy of Muslims. So I think we can see why you don't think the Muslims versus Israel framing is optimal, because it sends the message that this is just about religion. And as you said, it kind of resonates with, in America, a certain sense of wariness toward Muslims that many Americans have. That's enough. I mean, my main question is, does the antipathy part bother you? In other words, he focused a lot on antipathy. On both sides, and I guess more or less symmetrically. And so I guess if it hadn't had the kind of Muslim framing, but he had gone around and shown that, yeah, there are a lot of settlers who don't like Palestinians, there are also a lot of Palestinians who don't like Israelis, and had just referred to them as Palestinians, and let's suppose he had talked to Palestinian Christians, which I think he didn't, or at least it didn't come through in the article. Would that have been a problem as well? In other words, is delving into, you'd agree certainly there is antipathy on both sides at this point, right?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, here's the thing is that there's no question. I mean, I would even take it further. I wouldn't even just call it antipathy. I would say that there's, you know, actual hatred that is experienced on people on both sides. But it's important to remember that this hatred is a symptom of the conflict and not the driving cause of it. And to pretend it's the driving the cause of it, to pretend it is the driving cause, is basically flipping the entire issue backwards. Injustice is the driving force behind this conflict. And until you solve it, you're not going to be able to solve these, the symptoms. Just think of apartheid in South Africa. I'm sure there was plenty of black people who hated white people and plenty of white people who hated black people. But if you were trying to address the issue in South Africa and trying to look for a solution, you would be looking for resolving the apartheid system as step one. And then you would be talking about racial reconciliation and getting together and talking these things through. So that's what was missing, is that there was a strange focus on the symptoms of people not liking each other and not enough focus on the fact that there is a major structural injustice that Israel has imposed on the Palestinians, which is responsible for all these expressions and of negativity and acts of violence on both sides.
Okay. But is there sometimes value in exploring, I mean, without setting aside or forgetting about issues of justice and occupation and so on, in exploring kind of the landscape of emotion on both sides? Because when I've been to Israel a couple of times, and the last time I went there, which was, I guess, 2011, I actually spent most of the time in the West Bank. My sense has been that on on both sides, there's often not an entirely accurate perception of what's going on in the heads on the other side.
Yeah.
So I think Israelis do not, a lot of Israelis don't do a good job of just imagining the extent, the number of affronts to sheer dignity that Palestinians have to endure, and how their own sense of dignity would be affronted if they were in their shoes. On the Palestinian side, I think, while I was over there, one thing that some people I was there with tried to convince me of, and I think they were probably right, is that on the Israeli side, there is actual genuine fear. And a certain amount of it goes back to the second intifada when there were a lot of bombings in Israel and suicide bombings and so on. And I think probably there is a fair amount of genuine fear that just, if nothing else, helps explain some of the Israeli positions on, things when they start talking about two states or anything else. It helps you explain, or for that matter, it may help explain how they responded to the recent demonstrations in Gaza. But do you see value in that kind of symmetrical exploration?
Here's the thing. If in a theoretical media landscape where we have people who are talking accurately about the basically system of injustice that is imposed on Palestinians, I think this would become a worthy issue to explore as a supplementary, topic of conversation. But in the U.S. media landscape, where it is extremely difficult for people to get a grasp of the basic issue of what is actually unfolding on the ground, I think it ends up being a distraction. We're focusing on things. To focus on these kinds of explorations without actually making sure that the audience has a basic understanding of the fundamental injustice in play, I think is a problem. So theoretically, if we lived in a media environment where on the news people talked about the fact that the occupation is illegal, talked about the hardships that Palestinians live under, talked about the real basically obstacles to peace, about the fact that settlements have expanded nonstop throughout the entire so-called peace process, the fact that Israeli leaders have shown absolutely zero genuine interest in resolving this conflict, as evident by the fact that they've continued expanding those settlements while pretending to be interested in a two-state solution. If the audience has a basic understanding of all these facts, then I think it is absolutely worthwhile to explore sort of the fears and that people have on both sides and other issues. But until you convey that central issue, I think that you're really just getting people emotionally confused about this issue. You're getting them to a point where they're saying, both sides have reasons to be afraid of each other, both sides have legitimate concerns, and right and wrong, and just and unjust, and oppressor and oppressed, all of that actually just ends up disappearing. And that's really what I see as the fundamental problem here.
So the idea is that in principle, symmetrical exploration of the emotional landscape, and you might say symmetrical humanizing of the people even, can be a good thing. But you're saying, given the current, what you see is an imbalance in the perspective of Americans on this issue, the last thing you need to do basically is humanize settlers, kind of.
Is it the right time? I just remember him in one of the interviews where people asked him about, he said, people tell me, why are you humanizing settlers? And he said, because they're human, I have to. I mean, that's a perfectly fair point. There's nothing wrong with humanizing settlers. They are human beings. You should not dehumanize them. But the idea of going on a project to humanize settlers at a time when Palestinians are being trampled under occupation, with the full support of the Trump administration, we're basically having no prospects for freedom whatsoever. They can't return to their original homes in what later became Israel, and they can't have independence or freedom in a state of their own. To start to do a project about humanizing settlers under these conditions is basically moving us farther away from getting an understanding of what is happening. So there's nothing wrong in principle about humanizing anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is about the media environment that we live in, about the magnitude of the injustice Palestinians live under with the endorsement of the world's only superpower. And the focus here from somebody who claims to be a pro-Palestinian voice ought to be about that injustice that is imposed on the Palestinians.
Let me ask you a quick question about the media landscape. Are there, you pay a lot of attention probably to the way this story plays out in American media. Are there kind of better and worse? I mean, even among, I don't mean like, intensely ideological magazines. Like, I'm sure you'd say, like, The Nation does a better job than National Review, but if you just confine yourself to kind of mainstream media, cable news, New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, and I mean the repertorial side, not so much, not the editorial side, but the repertorial side, the networks, and so on, are there distinctions that most Americans are probably missing in terms of who, in your view, does a better job of illuminating the Palestinian perspective?
Sure. I mean, first, let me say that I think that it's fair to point out that there has been some improvement on this issue compared to 10 years ago or 20 years ago. But it's still far from where it needs to be. So this is the point where I struggle a little bit with wanting to celebrate the improvements, but at the same time knowing that they fall significantly short of where they ought to be. So some of the fact that Noura Erekat was on CBS News, you know, that's a positive. We don't usually have Palestinian voices represented in mainstream American outlets. The fact that my boss, James Zogby at the Arab American Institute, the fact that he was on MSNBC multiple times on major shows talking about this issue, that's progress. So this perspective is being allowed a little bit more space. It's nowhere near where it needs to be. You don't have an equal weight to Palestinian voices and Israeli voices or whatever. Like, the Palestinian perspective is not given as much space as it deserves on the issue of Palestine, but it is better than having no voice at all. Mm-hmm. In that sense, I think there is progress. I personally like Chris Hayes on MSNBC. I think he does a decent job with this and tries to be fair about it. Media, in print, it's hit or miss. I know a major complaint with the New York Times over the issue of the protests has been saying things like the Palestinians have died during the protests instead of pointing out the fact that it was Israelis that shot at them. You know, there's this, for some reason, there seems to be this mainstream aversion from laying responsibility at Israel's feet for things that Israel has actually carried out without any dispute.
Do you think in general the Washington Post does a better job than the New York Times on the repertorial side?
It's honestly, I have not paid close enough attention to make that comparison between those two in particular, but I would just say that there have been positive things coming out in both papers and some things that have been objectionable. Perhaps it might be true that I've noticed more positive things in the Washington Post, but I don't want to make that as a categorical claim.
Okay. Now, speaking of media, the piece in question was published in The Atlantic. And The Atlantic's editor has a history on this issue, Jeffrey Goldberg, and we can talk about that. How much of the controversy do you think is a result of where the piece appeared? I mean, if it had appeared in The New Yorker, we'll explain in a second why The Atlantic, you might have issues with The Atlantic, but if it had appeared in The New Yorker, do you think it would have created quite such a big fuss?
I think the piece on substance would have created a problem no matter where it was published. You know, there is something about the fact that a voice that has credibility as a pro-Palestinian voice misrepresenting this issue so badly, that's going to be a problem no matter where. I think there's certainly an added bit of controversy here with the fact that The Atlantic does not make space for Palestinians to present their views on that outlet. And for the editor, somebody like who has a history as being a prison guard in the Israeli military, deciding to send somebody like Wajahat Ali to visit with the settlers and come back, you can't help but feel like this is the range of so-called pro-Palestinian voices that he's comfortable with. And that's deeply problematic because it's one thing to not have a pro-Palestinian voice present. This way, the audience, even though that they're deprived of that perspective, at least they're aware of the fact that that perspective is missing and they are getting one-sided coverage. Mm-hmm. And it's another thing entirely to promote a nominally pro-Palestinian voice that does a bad job on this particular issue and basically have the Palestinian perspective end up being invisible while misleading the audience into thinking they're being exposed to the full spectrum and that they're getting sides on this. So I think that personal connection with the fact that Jeffrey Goldberg is the editor, he's been promoting this piece pretty heavily. He's inviting Wajahat back on the podcast to talk about this. And you're just left wondering, why aren't there stronger Palestinian voices to be talking about this? You know, there's no shortage of them.
Now, there is a Jewish writer for The Atlantic whom you'd probably agree does a better than average job of presenting the Palestinian perspective, Peter Beinart. Now, it's true that Jeff Goldberg didn't hire him. He inherited him when Jeff became the editor. And if you look at the people he's hired, he hasn't hired anybody in general that I would put on the left on foreign policy, period, leave aside this particular issue. But I assume you like a lot of Peter Beinart's work.
I do. But we have to remember that at the end of the day, he's somebody who self-identifies as a Zionist and a supporter of Israel. So he is highly critical of Israeli policies in ways that ought to be highlighted. You know, he does a great job criticizing Israeli, the occupation, the settlements, and so on. But at the same time, I think that the spectrum ought to be a little bit broader, and you should allow for voices that, you know, don't necessarily identify as Zionists, or are critical, or mm-hmm. more critical of Israel than Peter Beinart is willing to go even. There is no shortage of Palestinians who are very eloquent on this topic, who know how to talk about it, and who can present that perspective. And it's disheartening that that perspective is absent, and that people who don't have a good grasp on this issue get promoted in their place as the pro-Palestinian voice. And, you know, that's where the issue comes from. Is I remember that Wajahat, one of the things he complained about when he was on the show with you, was talking about how there is South Asian racism directed at South Asians because people are objecting to the fact that he's not Palestinian and speaking about this. But I really don't think that's racism at all. You know, there are people who do a good job who are not Arab or Palestinian who talk about this issue, and you rarely hear objections about that. People just want their issues represented. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to Wajahat, somebody who did not organically become a speaker on this issue, it's not like he's been spending his time blogging about Palestine and feels passionate about it, and then somebody like Jeffrey Goldberg said, oh, there's so much great work on Palestine here, let's see what this guy has to say. It was inorganic, you know? It was just plucking somebody who is not passionate about this issue, does not understand it well enough, and is not willing to take criticism on it, and deciding that this is the pro-Palestinian perspective that he's going to present. And I think then it's not about racism at all. There's legitimate frustration of saying, how come people who are, you know this issue better aren't the ones speaking on it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should say he is of Pakistani descent. And I assume that there is some correlation, I mean, you tell me, but among Muslims, I assume that on average, Arabs and even specifically Palestinians are somewhat more likely to feel this issue more intensely than I mean, that's in a way part of your critique of framing it as a Muslim issue, right? It's not a Muslim issue per se. It's much more of an Arab issue or a Palestinian issue.
That's right. And for people in Pakistan, it is primarily a religious issue. You know, they think that they have this religious tie to Jerusalem. You know, it must remain in the hands of Muslims or whatever. That's perfectly fine that this is how people feel about it. But the people who are living on the ground in Palestine, this is primarily home. This is not just a religious claim. This is about whether you can defend your home from occupiers. And the answer to that is an unequivocal yes, and that gets lost when you frame it as a religious issue.
Uh-huh. And do you, on the issue of him being kind of deplatformed by ISNA, by the Islamic Society of North America, do you have a view on that? That's a somewhat separate issue. I mean, you could hate the piece he wrote and still think that, you know, it isn't ISNA's job to form judgments about those things.
So I've fallen in the middle on this issue, I think, in a way that probably doesn't make anybody happy. On the one hand, I'm not a fan of boycotts of speakers or deplatforming. You know, I don't think that that's necessarily a particularly productive tactic to try to bring attention, because in many cases, you end up basically martyring the person you're going after, and you turn it into a free speech controversy when it ought not to be. Examples of that, you know, Ben Shapiro, just want to be clear, I'm not comparing Wajahat Ali to Ben Shapiro at all. Obviously, Ben Shapiro is someone who's just a flat-out bigot. But, you know, and he gets deplatformed because of his bigotry. People show up and demand that his talks be canceled at college campuses or whatever. And the next thing you know, somebody like Barry Weiss is writing a piece about him in the New York Times, you know, in this so-called intellectual dark web, romanticizing him as this, you know, iconoclastic intellectual, when all he is just a bigot that people don't want to have him speak over that. You end up distracting from the real issue at hand. And so I've always found it more useful to simply highlight what's wrong with people's opinions and views and why they're destructive or unhelpful or inaccurate, rather than campaign to try to get them boycotted or deplatformed. On the other hand, though, I would also say that if you engage on an issue that people feel very strongly passionate about in a way that is very counterproductive, and you basically end up responding to critics in the most appalling way possible, caricaturing them either as crazy or as anti-Semitic and so on, it is not surprising that organizations might not want to invite you to speak anymore. You know, like there's, you can't expect to be engaging on issues that people feel strongly about in a negative way and also still insist that they continue inviting you and feature you. It's just there seems to be a contradiction there. So yeah, I'm definitely not in favor of a boycott targeting Wajahat, but at the same time, it's difficult for me to see how he has a leg to stand on and complain when this is how he's choosing to engage on this issue. And the way he's engaging with critics is has been really, really problematic. You know, he was
in what sense?
So when he was on with you, he talked about how suggesting that Jeffrey Goldberg is using his perspective, that this is somehow an anti-Semitic take on the issue. I just want to back up a little bit and say that for anybody who is familiar with advocacy on Palestine in the United States, we all know that we're dealing with a serious struggle of the fact that the pro-Palestine movement is libeled, is basically defamed with the charge of anti-Semitism falsely all the time over virtually nothing. You know, even I, on media appearances, have been called an anti-Semite for simply pointing out what Israel is actually doing to the Palestinians in ways that are factual and that can be demonstrated by facts and statistics. And we live in an environment also where currently there's a guy named Kenneth Marcus that Trump just appointed to head the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education. And his whole thing is basically about conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism and saying that people who hold pro-Palestine events on college campuses are engaging in harassment of Jewish students.
Yeah, you mentioned him in the piece. Is he actually trying to make that policy? I mean, is he trying to implement that so that certain forms of criticism of Israel on college campuses would have negative consequences for the criticizer or something?
That's precisely it. Yes, he was at the Brandeis Center. He was hitting the Brandeis Center, and he was bringing complaints to the Department of Education about pro-Palestine events being held on campus, you know, some talk on Gaza or whatever. And he would suggest that this is basically making Jewish students on campus uncomfortable, and therefore the university has to do something about it. And he's been rebuffed repeatedly. The Department of Education kept writing back saying, this is First Amendment protected free speech issue. There is no harassment taking place here. Sorry, we're not going to take action on this. And now he's being placed in charge of the very office that was protecting us from him, in a sense, protecting students on college campuses from his interference.
So, what's his position now in the Trump? Oh, he's Assistant Secretary of Civil Rights in the Department of Education. Okay.
That's right. So he's heading that office. And then you have another worrying issue. You have Congress trying to expand the definition of anti-Semitism. There's this thing they're pushing in Congress right now called the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which basically wants to expand the definition of anti-Semitism to include criticism of Israel. You know, things like so-called demonizing Israel is not considered anti-Semitic under this bill. It hasn't passed yet, but if it were to pass.
What would be the consequences of that? I mean, anti-Semitism per se is not a crime in the United States. So what would it mean for Congress to, what would the consequences be of Congress's defining certain views as being anti-Semitic?
So it becomes a problem on college campuses because basically if it ends up passing as harassment or intimidation of students on campus, then these college campuses are going to take preemptive measures to chill pro-Palestine activism on campus out of fear that these Title VI complaints are going to end up heading in their way and be filed as civil rights complaints against the university. And the ACLU has been pretty vocal about it. They've actually spoken out against this. They said it is already illegal to engage in anti-Semitic harassment on college campuses. You don't need a new bill that expands the definition of anti-Semitism to allow that for that to happen. And when a civil rights giant like the ACLU is ringing the alarm bell saying this is really bad for civil rights, it's kind of time to pay attention. So back to Wajahat. This is
Let me say one more on this subject just quickly, because I read somewhere that the Texas university system or something has some, maybe this is totally wrong, I didn't check it, but has some policy where if you're going to give a talk at a university, you have to sign something saying that you're not in favor of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israel. Is that?
So I don't know exactly the different bills in different places, but there have been a couple of incidents. There was a town in Texas when it came to hurricane relief. They said they had to certify that you don't boycott Israel before you can qualify for hurricane relief. I mean, that's pretty horrific. There was a case in Kansas with a teacher who was trying to contract with the university, and she was asked to sign the same thing. And I think the ACLU fought a case on her behalf and ended up winning it. And they said she did not have to certify that she does not boycott Israel before she can she can qualify to teach. So we have these incidents appearing here and there, but you also have a national attempt. So it's not even, it's beyond local. Mm-hmm. You have a national attempt to pass something called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which is effectively trying to criminalize boycotts of Israel, or at least boycotts that follow international institutions that call for them, mm-hmm. like the UN Human Rights Council or Amnesty International and so on. And the ACLU has actually been vocal on this one as well. So we're dealing with this crisis where pro-Palestine activism is essentially, there are attempts to suppress it. And the false excuse of anti-Semitism is being basically used to silence pro-Palestine activism. So in that context, for somebody like Wajahat to come on your show and talk about how people who are criticizing him are somehow anti-Semitic because they're painting Jeffrey Goldberg as an evil Jew who's controlling him or whatever, this is really...
Didn't say broadly that his critics are anti-Semitic, did he? Now, in the piece... this is a slightly different issue. So go ahead. He didn't paint with that broad a brush, did he, in his conversation with me?
I would have to go back and listen to it, and I guess people can go back and look at that particular segment. But he basically said that people who are suggesting that Jeffrey Goldberg is using him in this way, that they somehow have...
That it's a trope of, like, conspiratorial Jews running the world. Was that the idea?
Yeah, precisely. I think that's what he was going for. And just, I think, given that context, we really should be careful and not throw that kind of imagery around. If it wasn't Jeffrey Goldberg, if it was, say, John Hagee, the pastor who runs Christians United for Israel, who's Christian and not Jewish, if he were running a publication as an editor and he found it suitable to publish Wajahat, people would be raising the exact same concern. So it has nothing to do with whether somebody is Jewish or not. It has to do with somebody who has a clear pro-Israel slant as an editor to a publication, choosing to highlight you as the pro-Palestinian voice on that publication.
Yeah, well, people can go back and look at what he said. I mean, I will say it's true that a number of his critics did mention that Jeff Goldberg had served in the Israeli army. I'm not saying that's necessarily anti-Semitic to say that, but they had connected Goldberg's perspective to his connection to Israel.
I think we're on the same page, is that I think that it's absolutely fair to draw that connection, that the person who is promoting you to present that view has a vested interest in the issue of Israel, so much so that he actually served in the Israeli military previously. That's worth noting without any suggestion that there's anything anti-Semitic about pointing these kinds of things out.
Okay. Last question about ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America. Do you think, I mean, my sense is that you can talk about the merits of the deplatforming. My sense is that it's just bad publicity for them. I mean, right? It's just not a good look. Especially when you've got all these Americans trying to paint Muslims in an unflattering way, right? So it's like, you know, it seems to me not great for them to appear highly specifically ideological in a way that seems to be associated with actually excluding voices, from a platform.
Yeah, and frankly, what made it worse, in my opinion as well, is the fact that Wajahat published a critique of the ISNA disinvite on The Atlantic as well, which was also misleading. You know, he said that the headline of the piece was, "I talked to Zionists and a Muslim organization disinvited me," or something like that. And again, the issue is never about talking to Zionists. You know, like, all of us talk with Zionists and engage with political opponents and debate, and nobody gets targeted by this. And that's the problem, is that you ended up basically painting a major American Muslim organization as being intolerant of people who talk to Zionists, and that's a caricature. You know, there wasn't sufficient depth of the actual objections that are being raised, and I think it's really important to talk about those actual objections as opposed to just dismiss it in that fashion.
Okay. So before we move on to the Israel-Palestine issue more broadly, I had said that I would try to be a stand-in for Waj and present the kind of pushback he would present. I don't really think I've actually done a lot of that. So let me at least say one thing in summary and see what you say about it, which is that, I think, and maybe he said this, but I can imagine him being motivated. I mean, I will say there's been a certain amount of kind of cynical interpretation of his motivations. And it all, as tempted as I always am to impute malign motives to people that really whose views really annoy me. At the same time, there's something I really don't like about it, and I've been a victim of it. I've had people, you know, make up stories about why I make certain arguments and stuff. And there was a certain amount of kind of, well, this is his ticket to MSM acceptability, to voice Jeff Goldberg's perspective and so on. And I can certainly imagine a less kind of nefarious motivation, which is just like you could have the view, as I basically have, that as a rule, it's a good thing to illuminate the perspectives on two sides of an issue, because after all, where there is conflict, it's typically the case that people on both sides are not fully understanding the actual perspective on the other side. And so, you do that, it's not as if all these settlers came off looking great. I mean, they were in a sense humanized, but a number of them came off not looking like paragons of fairness and balance, right? And then he also talked to some Palestinians, some of whom came off the same way. And so granted, maybe there was a kind of a symmetry there that you think is inappropriate in light of the asymmetry of power, which there undoubtedly is between Israel and the Palestinians and in various other asymmetries. But I can imagine somebody saying, well, this is generally a good thing to do this. The other thing I'd say is, as much as you might not like, I mean, this is more a comment on the average American's perspective on Israel-Palestine. Mm-hmm. But I imagine if the average American read this piece, it would actually move them slightly in your direction. Now, granted, the average American is not going to read the piece. It's in the Atlantic. It's for kind of an elite audience. And so it's not like it's going to really hit the heartland. But the truth is, there are a lot of Americans who, if they read something that's anything other than Palestinians are these crazy suicidal Muslims and Israelis are God's children, they're like blown away. You know, that's like a revelation. So, I mean, these are the things I would say, in defense of things he might say if he were here.
I'll take it a step further on a conciliatory note if we want to end the Wajahat conversation on a better note. I've been friends with Wajahat for many years, and frankly, you can't not like the guy. He's incredibly smart and charming and kind and generous. At the end of the day, that for me, this is... And let me also say that there has been a lot of criticism that was leveled against him that was also unfair. He's made it a point to only respond to these people, but it's also worth noting that there are a lot of people who are tweeting insane crap at him. That is completely, painting him in the worst ways possible that really crossed the line in a way that is completely unfair. That said, I still think that he's engaging with this issue in a way that, from my perspective, is harming the Palestinian struggle. And I just really wish he would be willing to be more open-minded about listening to those of us who are raising criticism. I know it's hard to notice us between all the noise of the people who are being just absolutely malicious and not holding back with personal insults and so on. But at the end of the day, this to me is about nothing more than making sure that we're pushing a correct narrative about Israel and Palestine moving forward. And as long as we're moving in that direction, I have absolutely no personal negative feelings towards him on a personal level.
Okay, good. That is a good way to end. So on Israel-Palestine broadly, in your piece that you co-authored with Noura Erekat, there were some notes of optimism. I mean, I think you said that younger Jews are, in your view, taking a more balanced perspective of this on average than earlier generation of Jews. And I think you said that the media environment is improving. In any event, you just said that. Are you optimistic right now? Because I don't know a lot of people who are.
Yeah. So I would separate what is happening on the ground in Israel-Palestine from the U.S. discourse aspect. If you look at the situation on the ground, I sadly cannot see any signs of hope. I think the Palestinians are completely isolated. They don't have anybody with real muscle who's willing to back them. You have a pretty extreme Israeli government right now under Netanyahu. I mean, most of the opposition that Netanyahu faces comes from his right, not from his left.
Right.
So he's a centrist in that spectrum, which tells you something about how scary that coalition is. They have no interest in granting the Palestinians any semblance of freedom. They have no problem opening fire on unarmed Palestinian demonstrators. And you have all of this happening with the endorsement of a U.S. administration that does not really value Palestinians in any way. So you have a rather disheartening dynamic on the ground. But if you set that aside and you look strictly at the American public discourse and media landscape, I think we're seeing things moving in the right direction. It is also partisan, and now it's increasingly partisan. I mean, it used to be that both sides were equally fanatically pro-Israel, and we're at a point right now where public opinion polls show that there's much bigger movement on the Democratic base in terms of being more even-handed and reasonable on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And you have major candidates like Bernie Sanders who are doing really unprecedented work on Palestine. You know, Bernie Sanders' office recently put out a video with interviews from people from Gaza talking about what it's like to live under siege and how the siege must end and how their lives are affected. You could never imagine a mainstream American political figure doing this sort of thing. And the fact that we're moving in this direction, I think, is really promising. Are we going to get to the point where in the short term this is going to lead to a major shift in American foreign policy? I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, it seems far-fetched to me at this point, but you never say never. You know, crazier things have happened, so we'll just have to see.
Well, not before 2020, certainly, right?
That's right.
January 2021. I mean, and that is another, I mean, it's just almost, from your point of view, just must be a complete nightmare. I mean, it's just almost unbelievable, you know, but because I'm sure you haven't been happy with, in general, the kind of American political establishment stance on Israel, but the Trump administration has just moved so far to the right on this.
And frankly, because the establishment was so pro-Israel to begin with, we encountered so many people during the election who would say things to me like, oh, who cares? Both sides are equally bad. They're all going to be the same. You know, it's just going to be the standard pro-Israel stuff. And I think from the beginning, some of us were warning that you can't say they're the same. Just because they're both bad doesn't mean they're both equally bad. And I mean, as much as I wished I had been wrong about this, I wasn't wrong about this. You know, Trump has really moved things in a much worse and uglier direction. You know, that there's given Israel a complete blank check to do whatever they want without any accountability or any consequence at all. And that is different.
I mean, in a way, that wasn't completely predictable. I mean, I was pessimistic about Trump, too, more so on foreign policy than most people were. But it's true that if you look at some of the things he was saying during the campaign, it was like, first of all, he was generally acting as if America should, you know, at least kind of not get involved in so many of other people's fights. And he said something at one point specifically about Israel-Palestine that seemed to suggest he would be moving like in your direction. But the opposite, the complete opposite has happened. And do you have kind of an explanation for that? I mean, I have my own theories, and certainly, you know, Sheldon Adelson has been a huge donor, and I mean, I gather moving the embassy was just kind of an explicit, was that almost an explicit deal? Is that your understanding? It's like, I'm going to give you a lot of money, and I want the embassy moved to Jerusalem. I mean, there's actually some evidence that it was that transactional, right?
It may very well have been. You know, it would not be surprising at all if it was. But in general, I thought that during the campaign, he was just talking out of his behind. You know, it was whatever came to mind. He wasn't a person with a conviction to be even-handed about this issue. He just thought that this is the right thing to say at the time. And eventually, as his chances for succeeding became more prominent, and he went to AIPAC and gave a speech there, eventually you could see where things were moving. And once he surrounded himself with the people that he did surround himself with, you know, David Friedman as a U.S. ambassador to Israel, at that point, you knew exactly what the policy was going to be. Somebody who does not have strong convictions about this conflict, surrounding himself by people who are very extremely pro-Israel and anti-Palestinian, was going to inevitably lead to the current policy that we see. David Friedman, for people who don't know, you know, he's the guy who accused Obama of being an anti-Semite at some point. He's a guy who described Jews who want a two-state solution in Israel-Palestine as capos. I mean, he's really as extreme as they come, and he even denies that the occupation exists at all. If this is your ambassador to Israel, there's no reason to believe that Trump was going to have an even-handed approach after that.
And he was just a lawyer of Trump's or something before, right? I mean, isn't he the one who had no relevant experience?
That's right. No, yeah, I can't remember what actually he did beforehand, some business related stuff. But yeah, just somebody with extreme views on this issue.
Yeah,
seem to play well with the base, basically.
So let's talk about a few things that are happening. For starters, there have been lately these demonstrations in Ramallah in the West Bank. I've just seen a couple of images where there were some pretty sizable turnouts. Is that a significant thing?
It's really hard to say. Honestly, I think that we're stuck in a dynamic right now where it's only a matter of time before we have another major round of violence. People have no hope whatsoever. There's nothing. There's no prospect for freedom as things stand right now, and the situation is pretty ugly and bleak. So this is really a perpetually unstable situation. There's a lot of frustration with the occupation. There's a lot of frustration with the Palestinian leadership. So it's hard to predict where things are going to go, but honestly, it's hard to imagine anything positive coming out of all of this in the short term.
And one of the main tools that activists are using right now is BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions of Israel. And there's, of course, huge pushback, as we've suggested, from Israel and some pro-Israel corners against this. To the point of, I mean, in Israel, kind of criminalizing it, I think, right? Criminalizing support of it.
And they're not allowing people who support BDS to come into the country. They're making it grounds for deportations and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, they're cracking on it pretty.
So, what are your and there have been some high profile cases, some of which were not, I guess, technically BDS. For example, Natalie Portman refused to, she backed out of a thing she was going to do in Israel. But when pressed, she said, well, it's not an overall BDS thing so much as an I don't want to be anywhere near Bibi Netanyahu, I think, who was going to be at that event in light of recent Israeli behavior. But there have been other cases as well where celebrities have decided not to perform in Israel and so on. Is this having actual impact?
We're still a very long way from having direct impact on Israeli policy. I don't think we're at the point to where Israeli leaders are really considering granting justice or freedom to the Palestinians because they're under that level of pressure. It hasn't reached that level yet. I think it's still at the level where it's creating some antagonism, though, where there is this major public backlash against it in Israel as well.
Is support for it growing? Is it of growing magnitude, the movement itself?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's no question that it's more in
Europe than in America, or in both?
I think that's fair to say that it's probably bigger in Europe than it is in America. I think we have a longer way to go on shifting discourse in the United States. We have a particular dynamic in this country where traditionally the media landscape has been very, very dominated by pro-Israel voices. And you have a very powerful lobby with AIPAC that is advocating and trying to criminalize basically the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in the U.S. and so on. So I think we have a longer way to go here, but there's no question that this is the direction in which things are moving. And it all comes from the complete failure of the political process, the diplomatic process, in applying any pressure on Israel. You know, people always talk about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions in this anti-Israel initiative, and why don't we just talk to them and negotiate and this and that. The truth is, we've negotiated. Negotiations have been ongoing for literally decades, trying to get something positive out of Israel, and they have not responded positively at all. They've made it clear that only pressure, basically, they've left people no option except grassroots pressure because nothing was happening on the political front. And from the U.S. perspective as well, this is particularly problematic because the U.S. has effectively acted as Israel's lawyer throughout all of this. Anytime the United Nations tried
to hold... One of the negotiators actually said that, is it Aaron David Miller, who was himself a negotiator, who said as much.
That's right. And you know, to the point to where the U.S. has intervened in the United Nations more than 40 times to veto resolutions that were critical of Israel or trying to hold Israel accountable. Just to put that in perspective, that's more than the total vetoes cast by all the other permanent members of the Security Council on all issues combined over the same period, you know, from the 1970s until today. So we have a major, you know, the U.S. policy has been a major obstacle to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So the fact that people are taking it matters into their own hands is unsurprising at all. And frankly, it is the only option that is left for people who feel a sense of solidarity with the Palestinians, but don't see a political avenue to promote justice for them.
Okay. a thing that I and some other people have always thought would be powerful if it were politically doable in Palestine, and I mentioned this in talking to Lodge, is, and I understand, having talked to Palestinians, why they don't consider it viable, but if they just started saying, particularly in the West Bank, which is under formal occupation as opposed to Gaza, where Israel controls it more by controlling the borders, enforcing a blockade, and launching attacks periodically. In the West Bank, people started demonstrating peacefully and saying, okay, you clearly aren't going to let go of this land. We would just like to vote in Israeli elections. Now, before we get to why that's not a favored tactic, do you agree that would draw a lot of international support? And really, even in America, I think it might resonate. I mean, if people said, wait a second, they just want to vote in elections about the government that actually does govern them, that actually rules their territory? I mean, do you agree that it would get a lot of attention internationally and would have that going for it, first of all?
I do. I think it's double-edged. So on the one hand, I think it is the basic principle of one person, one vote is so universal. Anybody who values democracy and freedom will obviously get behind that sort of messaging. On the other hand, I think that there is the public relations problem of Israel then gets to turn around and say, this is just a ploy because they want to destroy the Jewish state, right? They don't want the Jewish majority, and they think that if we all get together on this one state, then there is no more Israel. That is the actual outcome of having one state, is that it won't be Israel. It would effectively be a Palestine with a Jewish minority. So, you know.
And you think that would carry the day? I mean, there's a separate reason that this idea doesn't gather a lot of support in Palestine, which is that to say I want to vote in Israeli elections is felt to be a kind of legitimizing or normalizing of Zionism or of the occupation. You're kind of, in a sense, buying into the idea that Israel.
I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't know if that's a major factor.
You think it's more tactical consideration?
I think it is tactical in the sense here. I mean, here's the primary issue with one state advocacy. We're moving to a point to where the prospect for independence, Palestinian independence in the West Bank is almost non-existent, given the sheer number of settlements that Israel has built. You know, 700,000 Israeli settlers are living in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So it makes sense that then you transition to one state advocacy. But the counter argument to that is, if you can't get Israel to relinquish control of 22% of historic Palestine, how is it easier to expect them to relinquish the Zionist project altogether and basically allow for all of it to become effectively a Palestinian state where everybody has equal rights? I think that's really a very strong argument. And in the current power dynamic, I find it very difficult to imagine how a two-state solution could come about, as much as I find it equally difficult how a one-state solution could come about.
Well, go ahead and finish, and I'll tell you.
No, I basically just think that we're stuck in this power dynamic where Israel holds all the cards, and while both options, you know, the two-state solution is a Palestinian compromise. It was never the Palestinian desire. The Palestinian desire has always effectively been for a one-state, like a one-man, one-vote for everyone. Would probably be what Palestinians would choose if they had the option. The two-state solution was a compromise, feeling that they have to accept the Zionist project as a reality because Israel is incredibly powerful and has established itself, and you can't turn the clock back. They saw it as a pragmatic way forward to say, okay, fine, two-state solution on the internationally recognized border that the UN established on the pre-67 borders. That was the practical approach forward. And as Israel increasingly makes the practical approach forward impossible, I think it only makes sense that we end up shifting to one state advocacy. But I also know that there is quite a bit of tension on, have we given up on ending the occupation altogether? Because if there is hope for it, you know, any prospect for a one state solution where everybody lives together under equal rights, there is no roadmap to that in the short term. It's not going to be achieved in 10 years. It's not going to be achieved in 20 years. This is an incredibly long-term project, right? And I sympathize with some level on people who still see hoping that there is a way to save the two-state solution because they see it as more realistically achievable in the short term, even though it is increasingly difficult.
Well, see, my thought had been the only hope for saving the two-state solution would be the tactic I described, because if Palestinians really started kind of credibly saying, okay, give us the vote, and that started gathering international support, I think you'd see Israel offer a more generous two-state solution than has been offered so far. That was actually what I had in mind. Go ahead.
That's certainly possible. It might push things in that direction. But alternatively, I think Israel seems to be on the path of not caring what international pressure is, as long as they have the support of the U.S. administration, which is effectively sponsoring Israel with $40 billion in military aid over a period of 10 years, unprecedented military aid that we don't give to any other country. As long as they have that support and the diplomatic protection I mentioned at the United Nations, I think they can just get away with doing whatever they want to do. And it seems increasingly clear that what their approach is to take whatever parts of the West Bank that they want and to confine the Palestinians into smaller and smaller areas, and effectively create these isolated cantons in the West Bank that Palestinians can just take over. I remember that an aide of Netanyahu a long time ago, it might have been in the 90s, said, we'll give them the pieces of land that we want to give them, and then they can call it whatever they want. They can call it a state if they want. They can call it fried chicken if they want. We don't care. And I think that this is basically the direction in which we are moving. And it's going to come down to international pressure whether this process can be reversed.
And do you see why Israelis worry that that a one-state solution? Well, first of all, do you think it's at all plausible what many of them fear, which is that if there's a one-state solution, I mean, I think a lot of them imagine really being chased out of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of them who actually think that would happen. And, you know, they can point to pieces of rhetoric that would seem to, that various people have uttered that might seem to support that. But do you agree that for a lot of them, that is the actual fear, and whether or not it's well-founded, it's a genuine fear?
It may very well be. We come back to the fact that the alternative is ending the occupation, and they seem to show no interest in that whatsoever. So it's hard to sympathize with that fear if your vision is to just not grant these people any kind of freedom and to keep them under the boot of your control indefinitely. That's not a legitimate alternative by any stretch. But let me say this also. I think that, looking around the region, there are certainly reasons to be anxious. We look at how minorities end up in different parts of the Middle East are not doing particularly well. So I get that fear might not be entirely imaginary, but I also think that we can start, just look at support for suicide bombings among Palestinians as a random example. During the peace process, when Palestinians felt a genuine prospect in having freedom from occupation, support for Palestinian violence really dropped down to an all-time low. And it was only when it became clear that Israel was not interested in ending the occupation or giving the Palestinians anything, is when support for Palestinian violence had actually increased. So that, to me, is the fundamental issue, is that what ends up determining the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians has to do with peace and goodwill rather than might. It becomes a chicken and egg situation where if you think that you have to impose your dominance on them in order to protect yourself from them, when that dominance is precisely the reason why you have anything to fear to begin with, it makes a lot more sense to be building goodwill towards the Palestinians, allowing them to live normal lives. And then that would actually be leading us towards a trajectory where the prospect of people living together as equals without problems increases significantly. And that really is the vision that might be the right one for the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think their sense of threat actually goes beyond Palestinians. I mean, I think they look around them and see threats everywhere they look. And there are some threats. There's certainly a lot of hostile rhetoric, but
but just on that point, I want to say something that Noam Chomsky pointed out a while back. Israel faced its most existential threat in 1973 when it was territorially at its largest. It had all of the Sinai, and that was the war when it came closest to basically being destroyed. So it's not about the size of the land that you control. At the end of the day, the idea that the occupation over Palestine is for security, right, is total nonsense. This stuff cannot be solved by might. You're going to live in perpetual anxiety if this is the approach. You have to reach a sensible peace agreement with your neighbors where they're allowed to live normal lives, and that really is the best ticket towards security for everyone.
Okay, when you said that, you know, there was the shift toward supporting violence and suicide bombings came when hopes for a peaceful solution dissipated. Are you talking about like right near the end of the Clinton administration, where there was that last gasp effort?
Yeah, effectively, with the Second Intifada, it was clear that throughout the peace process, Israel just kept building more. I mean, they kept saying, let's negotiate an end to the occupation, while on the ground, they were making the occupation more difficult to end. They just kept expanding settlements. And once it became clear that there was no prospect for Palestinian freedom, that this is not what Israel was really interested in having, and then there was an incident in Jerusalem that triggered the violence when Ariel Sharon entered the Muslim part of Temple Mount and the violence broke out. At that point, you know, there was support for violence because people saw that basically negotiations were not leading to anything positive. Once it was perceived that the other side had no genuine goodwill and a good faith effort towards resolving the conflict, that's when support for violence increased.
And do you think they've ever been very close to a deal? Because the positions of the two sides tend not to actually be made public and official. I mean, there is reporting on what one side was offering or the other side was offering. And there's also reporting to the effect that at that point, Yasser Arafat just felt that the politics on his side were not conducive to a deal. But all of this is just kind of background reporting, and you never know what the positions were. Do you think they've ever been close?
So the sense that I have is that the most Palestinians have been offered officially was in Camp David 2, which is right before the Second Intifada. Mm-hmm. And the person who was Israel's foreign minister at the time, Shlomo Ben-Ami, said that had he been Palestinian, he would not have accepted that deal. So even by the Israeli foreign minister's view at the time, the Palestinians were not offered anything that came close to being a viable state. They got even closer during the Second Intifada, during the Taba negotiations shortly after. Mm. And that was, I think, is when they actually genuinely came the closest to resolving the conflict. But both sides had anxieties and had reservations. And Ehud Barak at the time ended up withdrawing because he came under pretty heavy criticism from the Israeli right that he was somehow giving the Palestinians too much. And he did not want to face that kind of pressure going into the election. He ended up losing the election anyway. But mm-hmm. in theory, that may have been the closest we had come. But let me just say one more thing on that front. It is absolutely crucial to remember that throughout all of these negotiations, the only side that was being asked to make compromises was the Palestinian side, because international law says that the Palestinian territories are occupied. West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem are all occupied Palestinian territories that Israel must withdraw from. And the negotiations there was never any negotiations about Israel itself. All the negotiations were about how much of the occupied territories Israel was going to withdraw from. And so in that sense, it was only a question of how much compromise were the Palestinians willing to make, how many concessions, when Israel was being asked of absolutely no concessions whatsoever.
And when that deal, not Taba, but the deal that the Israeli, what was it, foreign minister said he would not have accepted?
That was Camp David 2.
That was Camp David 2. What were the things that, in his view or in yours, made it not acceptable? Was it just the amount of land or the location of the land swaps, or did it also have to do with the structural nature of the state in terms of control of borders and stuff like that? I mean, what were the least acceptable parts of it?
So effectively, I think you've alluded to most of these most of the issues. Israel wanted to maintain control over the Jordan Valley, which is on the east of the West Bank. So in effect, a Palestinian state would not control its own borders. They were going to keep pretty significant settlement blocks, ones that, you know, especially around Jerusalem, that effectively cut the West Bank in half. It was basically a level of control over the Palestinian territories where you could not really call it a viable Palestinian state.
Okay. So at this point, like, what do you wake up hoping for every morning? I mean, what kinds of developments are good in terms of, I don't know, forms of resistance you see or what? I mean, it sounds like if you've given up on two states, as I think many careful observers have, you are in for a long, long mm-hmm. haul. And so what are you hoping for at this point in the near term?
Because I it's hard for me to envision a roadmap right now forward in the short term that leads to resolving this conflict, either in one state or a two-state direction. They both seem pretty far-fetched as things stand now. I'm standing back from trying to envision what the solution would look like and saying that we really just ought to have a human rights approach and talk about what U.S. policy is and how it needs to shift. So from my perspective, what I'm after is making sure that the United States no longer supports Israel's illegal and immoral behavior against the Palestinians. And once Israel feels that that support is not there anymore, they're going to have to sit down with the Palestinians and really figure out what that solution is. And I'm open to whatever that solution ends up being. So from my perspective, it really is just primarily about ending U.S. support for Israel's oppression of the Palestinians. That's really the extent of it, as far as I can think. All of it based on a human rights approach, based on the fact that the range of human rights violations that Israel commits against the Palestinians is so extensive. We have laws in the U.S. that say you can't sell weapons or give weapons to countries that are engaged in gross human rights violations. And it's time to implement those laws, the Leahy Law, the International, the Arms Export Act, and so on. It's time to start applying them to Israel. There's no reason why we don't apply them.
Okay, and final question. The climate on American campuses, both in terms of BDS per se, but also in terms of level of engagement, level of attention to this issue, do you see that moving in your direction?
I think so. I think that there is a lot more awareness about what's happening in Palestine. You know, the boycott movement on college campuses is pretty huge. But at the same time, what we talked about earlier with Ken Marcus coming in as the head of the Office of Civil Rights under Trump, I don't know which direction things are going to be moving in the short term. I mean, we'll see how hardly they crack down on campus activism. But there is generally hope in the fact that the younger generation gets this issue so much better than the old one. And it's only a matter of time before U.S. policy shifts. I just wanted to shift sooner rather than later because real lives are at stake. This is not something that we can just, you know, sit on our hands and wait and see what happens, because every day Palestinian lives are being lost under the violence of the occupation.
Okay. Well, thank you, Omar. Now, where can people find your stuff? Do you have a Twitter handle or something you'd...
I do have a Twitter handle. It's Omar Badar, just my name. And then there's the organization I work for, the Arab American Institute, also does a lot of great work on this issue. The Twitter handle there is at AAIUSA.
Okay, and your handle is OMARBADDAR with no dot in the middle?
That's right.
Okay. All right, well, thank you for taking the time, and maybe we'll check in down the road.
Absolutely, great. Thank you so much for the chat.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.